17. 9/11 Truth Seekers and Campaigners, It's Your Lucky Day. May 2008. So, you want a new investigation into the events of 9/11? Well, it's your lucky day. There is one already in progress. However, it is ignored by almost all 9/11 researchers and posters around the Internet. The RFCs and the key TAMs presented by Dr. Judy Wood and Dr. Morgan Reynolds against NIST and its contractors are independent, and they are investigations, but most 9/11 truthers are not talking about them. In this article, I will ask why this is the case. A focus on the truth of 9/11. I've been pondering what seems to be happening to the effort across various groups to reveal the truth of what happened on 9/11. Some quite unusual things seem to have been transpiring over the last 2 years, as I have tried to document in previous articles posted on my website. Last month, in mid-April of 2008, 9/11truth.org sent out an email regarding a Week of Truth initiative featuring fairly well-designed graphics and a prominent posting of Steve Alton's new novel, The Shell Game. This work, seemingly written as a vehicle to further the aims of 9/11 truth campaigners, additionally has the laudable goal of raising money for the New York City first responders who suffered greatly for helping others on the day of this most terrible tragedy. The accompanying message from 9/11truth.org suggested buying copies of The Shell Game directly through weekoftruth.org so that a portion of the purchase price, it doesn't say how much, will go to the first responders. Purchasing a copy will also, it says, help the book to enter the New York Times top 10 bestseller list. Additionally, it suggests emailing everyone you know who wants 9/11 truth to break through the corporate media blackout, and that people should write op-eds and call into radio shows, and otherwise tell people about the Week of Truth. Who could argue with the basic thrust of these suggestions? I certainly couldn't. However, if I may adopt a more lyrical but critical tone for a moment, I fear that this Week of Truth may have been Week, W-E-A-K, of Truth. Why am I being so harsh in describing the efforts of kind-hearted people to selflessly promote the knowledge that the official story, also known as OGCT, of 9/11 is false? First, I think it is important to consider what the shell game actually says. For example, the plot of the story includes Iran's supposed nuclear reactor development, which of course is disputed, and also discusses the issue of peak oil, also disputed but often cited by some 9/11 researchers as the main reason 9/11 was perpetrated. So, even if the shell game helps more people become aware of and think about 9/11 truth issues, and I question whether it actually will, I would contend it is falsely suggesting that peak oil and Iranian nukes are real issues of concern, in the same way that the official story of 9/11 suggests that international terrorism is an issue of real concern. When, in the Week of Truth, or at any other time for that matter, people make phone calls or send emails to tell others about 9/11 truth and the shell game, what do they say? One of the easiest phrases to use seems to be, 9/11 was an inside job, meaning that the government and probably other officials knew in advance that the event was going to happen and that they, in some way, planned and or assisted in the execution of the operation. However, as shocking as the statement is to some people, that statement in and of itself moves us little or no further forward in finding or prosecuting the perpetrators. Indeed, does purchasing a copy of the shell game help towards this goal? Additionally, many people are already uncomfortable with the official story of 9/11. According to an August 2006 Scripps Howard Ohio University national survey, 36% of Americans believe 9/11 was an inside job, with government agencies complicit in what occurred. A Zogby poll in 2004 also produced similar results. With this in mind, and knowing what I know now, I am much more concerned about the long-term effect that the shell game may have, because it does not include important evidence and information related to what the latest 9/11 research has revealed. 9/11, the physical evidence. One of the things that a study of 9/11 truth should teach us is to focus on evidence. This study of evidence can be applied both directly to the analysis of the events of 9/11, and it can also be applied to the study of events since 9/11. An important question that might be asked is this: what have the perpetrators of 9/11 been up to since that day? We know for sure that media have been manipulated. Key evidence has not been reported or discussed. For example, it is very rare to hear a discussion about how the towers, including most of the steel, largely turned to dust. It is also almost unheard of anywhere, in relation to the supposed WTC plane crashes, that thin aluminum wing struts cannot cut through steel girders, whatever speed they are traveling at. This is because of Newton's third law and the relative hardness of these two materials. In a collision, the force on the aluminum is the same as the force on the steel, but aluminum wing struts are much weaker than steel, so they snap, and the steel does not. It often surprises me that only a small number of people appear willing to focus on and discuss the physical evidence. For example, Mike Rupert, it has been noted, was reluctant to discuss physical evidence when he started writing about 9/11. More recently, within the 9/11 truth movement, which can perhaps be regarded as the 9/11 official truth movement, many people seem very reluctant to discuss the current legal cases of Drs. Wood and Reynolds, even though information about their legally based efforts has been in the public domain for well over 1 year. I would contend that the reason for this lack of discussion is that discussion and analysis of information within the 9/11 truth movement is being subjected to the same type of bullying, cajolery, and name-calling that is present in the mainstream media whenever this topic is discussed. When anyone appears to question the official story, they are attacked and ridiculed, and discussion of their research is subjected to pernicious debunking. To try and document this activity, I posted an article which attempted to illustrate, using the evidence I had collected, how factions of the 9/11 truth movement were being manipulated and controlled. This behavior continues today unabated. Video fakery on 9/11 and ongoing psyops. Comprehensive studies of evidence pertaining to video fakery and manipulation, such as those presented in September Clues, illustrate in a compelling manner the scale of the psyop which was employed in cementing the mythical hijacker's tale into the psyche of the general population. Once an understanding is gained of how the video fakery and associated media spin and information manipulation has been working, it becomes much clearer to see how the psyop tactics have also been at work within the 9/11 truth movement itself. One such success story is that of molten metal. It is a story that has been repeated many times but seemingly with increasing frequency since about late 2005 or early 2006, in quite a similar fashion to the official hijacker myth. The story was one of the main points of Stephen E. Jones's February 2006 USVC presentation and his earlier paper entitled Why Indeed Did the WTC Towers Completely Collapse? Like the hijacker fable, the molten metal story seemed to make sense initially, and I too was taken in by them both, but when you have been presented with only a subset of evidence and then discover an unrevealed body of evidence and analyze it, the fake story is exposed for what it is. When the evidence for thermite, and especially molten metal, is studied in depth, thanks to the evidence uncovered largely by Dr. Judy Wood, I can only sensibly draw the conclusion that this particular story is as fake as the hijacker story. Despite this evidence, most people in the 9/11 truth movement, even some of those who might be called figureheads, still discuss thermite and molten metal as being the established cause and effect of the destruction of the WTC complex. Challenging the CDers. Some regard the WTC destruction as being the result of carefully placed and precisely detonated explosives, i.e., traditional controlled demolition, TCD for short, as well as there being various flavors of thermite in use. When I first started to research into 9/11 issues, I generally agreed that some type of explosive demolition was used, although the top-down demolition of Towers 1 and 2 was peculiar. Thanks in part to Dr. Wood's photo studies, I later became aware of new evidence, such as 1. Toasted cars approximately a mile away from the WTC. 2. Upturned cars in several locations. 3. At least one witness diving under an ambulance during the destruction of one of the towers, then reporting that the ambulance was, quote, pushed off during the destruction. 4. At least one spontaneous car fire at 9:46. before the towers were destroyed. 5. No bright flashes seen as the towers are destroyed. 6. Severe powderization of the buildings, leaving a debris pile less than a story high in many places. 7. A dust cloud which was not hot. No one got burned. Now, as you'll appreciate, OGCT believers ignore a lot of evidence in maintaining their belief that hijackers and planes caused the damage on 9/11. TCD, traditional controlled demolition, believers, I used to be one, ignore the evidence above and such things as hosing down of the WTC site as late as January of 2008. I videoed it myself, and the ongoing problems with the Bankers Trust building. Of course, by ignoring any amount of evidence about anything, be it a scientific or legal matter, it is possible to come to almost any desired conclusion. However, the value of that conclusion is, of course, likely to be inversely proportional to the amount of evidence ignored. Ignoring the evidence, an active denial system? I'm sure there are a few people in the world who believe the Earth is flat, and they can continue to do this by ignoring the evidence that it is a sphere. For example, brushing off all satellite photos as fakes. People in the 9/11 official truth movement are vociferously critical of mainstream media figures, as well as other well-known figures, for not talking about the evidence. This very situation has recently been the subject of an article by the author Eric Larson. Yet when it is pointed out that people even within the 9/11 official truth movement refuse to address evidence, a number of prolific internet forum posters typically become very defensive, or even rude and insulting. In trying to draw attention to some of the evidence and general conclusions that Dr. Wood and Dr. Reynolds have researched and posted articles about, I too often seem to have experienced animosity and hostility. This mirrors the earlier experience of people like Rosalie Grable, Web Fairy, Nico Hout, Gerard Holmgren, and others. Those that have been the most critical rarely focus on a considered analysis of evidence in question. Typically, the conclusions drawn from what has become known as DEW and No Planes research are often said to be impossible to believe by those in the 9/11 official truth movement. It can be observed that they frequently use disturbingly similar language to that used by OGCT believers, who cannot accept that a conspiracy regarding 9/11 really does exist, even when it is pointed out that the evidence for DEW and no planes at the WTC is so strong that it has been used both as a basis for 2 requests for corrections and 2 related key TAM cases against NIST contractors. It is often not regarded as significant. I can say this of at least 6 9/11 truthers that I have met and discussed these issues with. Some of them use phrases such as, "I have seen no evidence of DEW," and "I looked at Dr. Wood's website and saw no evidence of significance." I find this so bizarre that I really do wonder what is going on. The following sample of correspondence I had with a European scientist is typical of some of the extraordinary exchanges I have been a party to. 1. Concerning toasted cars a mile away from the WTC. The cars were toasted by falling thermite and moved subsequently so the rescue squads could get access to GZ. There is no evidence that this is true. How did the thermite travel a mile and spread over hundreds of cars? Where are the photos or witness testimony that so many cars were moved? I'd be happy to see it. How did the thermite selectively react with only some parts of the cars? To another point of evidence, Herrett makes a non sequitur response. 3. Concerning at least one witness diving under an ambulance during the destruction of one of the towers, then reporting the ambulance was pushed off during the collapse. If you can repeat that experiment, I would like to see it. Even sending a volume of additional evidence to this person was not enough to stimulate any further reasoned discussion. This person clearly seems to support the conclusions made by Stephen E. Jones regarding thermite and thermite. It cannot be noted often enough that Stephen E. Jones represents one of the key connections between the 9/11 cover-up and the energy cover-up, see below. twisting the evidence. In one or two discussions I've had where I've attempted to discuss the powderization of steel, it has been declared impossible because the amount of energy required to melt and vaporize the steel would be so high as to not be deliverable. In one case, the person went to the trouble of calculating the required energy to do this. He came out with a figure in gigawatts. This sort of stunt can be observed repeatedly. We discussed dustification or powderization, but this is twisted into melting and vaporization, and the process is then declared impossible. If it was impossible, then where are the steel girders? And if there really was molten metal, then where did the energy come from to melt the steel? The arguments presented in opposition to the evidence that steel turned to dust don't stand up to scrutiny. Exposing the evidence. Recently, I asked someone I know here in the UK who has repeatedly spoken out about a number of 9/11 truth-related issues for help in publicizing the Wood Reynolds Key Tam cases, following comments this person made regarding an email exchange I had with BBC producer Mike Rudin. Mike Rudin was the series producer of The Conspiracy Files, which included a program which did not properly address the key 9/11 evidence contradicting the official story. I asked this person, who was quite well known in UK 9/11 truth circles, how do we get coverage, at least of the existence of these two cases, even if not the details or the names of the people involved, for heaven's sake, into the Daily Mail? Can you advise me, please? So, can you help me publicize the Key Tam cases anyhow? That would be great. This person, who has spoken out publicly regarding 9/11, does have some contacts in the UK media. He responded thus: to do this, we need to be credible. To be credible, we need to avoid speculation. For the above reasons, I shall respectfully have to decline your request for help in publicizing the work of Woods. This response was interesting to me for two reasons. First, it mentions speculation. Both Dr. Woods and Dr. Reynolds' Key Tam cases focus on a range of physical evidence. They draw certain conclusions based on an analysis of this evidence. This is really the opposite of speculation. Indeed, who would initiate a court case based on speculation? Who has this kind of money to waste? The second point that was interesting was that this person said they would, quote, not help in promoting the work of Woods, unquote. This was not exactly what I asked. There are two Key Tam cases, and I did not specify that the names be mentioned, and of course it's Dr. Wood, not Dr. Woods. Over the last 2 to 3 years, I have helped with the running of the UK 9/11 Truth Forum. Previously, when I posted information or updates pertaining to the RFCs of Dr. Wood and Dr. Reynolds on the UK forum, they were moved out of the news section and into the controversies section. So moderators there seem to be indulging in a kind of soft censorship, in a similar manner to how news editors move some stories to the back pages or put them in smaller print. The call for an independent investigation. I recently received a message from a friend who is now starting to realize what seems to be going on. In presenting his view to other people, he wrote, "I have been pondering over a few things regarding what we are trying to achieve. We are primarily demanding a reinvestigation of 9/11. But what would we accept as a satisfactory investigation? What criteria would we use to measure or qualify any investigation, whether it is just a proposal or an actual investigation? I didn't consider until recently that the Judy Wood Key Tam cases are technically investigations, since the cases brought forward have been accepted by the courts. Yet we have collectively chosen to ignore them, as they do not fit some criteria that we must collectively all share. Please forgive the generalization for a second. What are those criteria?" So this does lead on to a deeper question. What form would a truly independent inquiry take? Who would pay for it? If government bodies cannot be trusted, and they cannot, how about an organization like Amnesty International? Wouldn't they be able to do something? Well, seeing as AI has made no public comment concerning 9/11 issues in over 6 years, despite being asked, The prospects aren't looking too good. So perhaps we need individuals to come forward, fund their own research, build their own legal cases, and submit them to the court. At the moment, Drs. Wood and Reynolds, with the help of Jerry Liebhardt, are the only ones doing this, as all previous 9/11-related cases have either folded or been withdrawn. So why hasn't anyone else tried to reinvigorate them? 9/11, the Hutchison effect, and the energy connection. It has been said that the flak is strongest when you are over the target, and I can't help thinking that this applies to our current situation, where, along with Dr. Wood, I have been involved with pointing out the similarities between some of the less well-known effects at the WTC and some of the effects seen in John Hutchison's experiments. Using a maximum of about 4 kilowatts of power, Hutchison has carried out, admittedly often in a haphazard fashion, experiments for the last 30 years and in the process generated about 500 pounds of anomalous metal samples. This has attracted interest from the U.S. military industrial complex organizations, such as Los Alamos National Laboratories. It is therefore less surprising that he has submitted an affidavit for Dr. Judy Wood's Ketam case, now filed with the Court of the Southern District of New York. This, of course, means that if John Hutchison were to be called as a witness, if the case proceeded, he could go to prison if he committed perjury. We have mentioned the similarities of some of the characteristics of the Hutchison effect and what is referred to as cold fusion. In both cases, attempts are made to debunk the phenomenon by denying the reproduction of experiments. John Hutchison has replicated his experiments many times, and Mel Winfield has reproduced some similar effects. With cold fusion, there have been hundreds of replications, many of which have showed anomalous nuclear effects, excess heat, or both. Sometimes, the reaction appears to be self-sustaining for an extended period after the current was removed from the experiment. Further information is available at lenr-canr.org. And of course, this is where Professor Stephen E. Jones enters the picture, as he was involved in matters which triggered the somewhat impromptu or even premature press conference of Pons and Fleshman in 1989. Should be pointed out that, in relation to 9/11, not only is Professor Jones' evidence unverifiable, some of his statements are false or unsubstantiated. His behavior can, on scrutiny, also be justifiably questioned. In the late 80s and early 90s, Jones and others went on to completely ignore or deny the reality of excess heat production in a number of duplicate experiments. These matters are documented in Dr. Eugene Maloff's excellent 1991 book, Fire from Ice. Maloff was murdered in May of 2004. Jones appeared on the 9/11 scene in about September of 2005. Maloff worked with William Zabur at the New Energy Foundation. William Zabur was the uncle of Michael Zabur, Dr. Wood's student. Can it just have been a coincidence that Michael Zabur was himself murdered in March of 2006? The normal no-planers are just completely nuts. Dr. Reynolds' Ketam case focuses on the lack of evidence of plane impacts at the WTC on 9/11. In April of 2008, these so-called no-planers were accused of physically abusing one or more members of one of the New York We Are Change group. These accusations were made in a Prison Planet article, with a summary that follows. My emphasis added, We Are Change to release assault videos. After months of tolerating verbal and physical abuse from a fringe group of emotionally unstable no-planers at Ground Zero, Luke Rudkowski and We Are Change have had enough, and we are set to release videos showing the assaults and attempts to smear We Are Change as being complicit in the Times Square Recruitment Center bombing. The use of the phrase emotionally unstable is somewhat revealing. In an earlier broadcast on the referenced Alex Jones radio show, we seem to have had another example of debunking, ridicule, and insulting remarks where, instead of a sober analysis of the evidence included in Dr. Reynolds' case, would have been more appropriate and useful. In an earlier broadcast, around April 8th of 2008, Alex Jones made his position on this evidence abundantly clear, saying, "And then who comes out and says, 'There are no planes,' former Bush administration officials, and Fox has them on over and over again, and Fox, whenever I'm doing a debate, they say, 'No planes, ha ha ha.' The normal no-planers are just completely nuts. I mean, they are completely out of their minds and vicious and aggressive and lying and slanderous. And then they've always got former admitted spooks, former admitted people from CIA universities running around spewing." He goes on. Attorney Jerry Liepart, in a letter to Alex Jones, responded to this general accusation. "We hasten to acknowledge that we are not saying you accuse Drs. Wood and Reynolds of such behavior. However, we do say that they are known as no-planers by some, and we also know how guilt by association and categorization works. And we know that you know that, too. I am assuming here that you do not want any of us to come under surveillance by virtue of being thought to pose a threat of violence. You might not share the same degree of wariness about surveillance as we do, but we assume it takes very little in the way of publicly disseminated information to give rise to justification for surveillance. Posting videos proclaiming that no-planers have instigated or participated in fighting could be used as a justification for scrutiny, in our view." Alex Jones has often been heard to say, "Don't believe me. Do your own research," or words to that effect. I hope that in this particular case, people will do as he suggests. The common thread. If one wants to find the truth of something which is not fully understood, one can only do so by continually collecting evidence, analyzing it, and drawing conclusions. Importantly, however, this is never a completely static process. An unconditional willingness to review new evidence is the only way to get the closest to the truth. Evidence, analysis, and conclusions must be continually reviewed and refined, and this process is surely one of the fundamental pillars of the scientific method, which I prefer to think of more as analytical thought. In much of the activity documented above, there is a common thread, that of ignoring evidence. A friend of mine has an expression that is also appropriate here. He describes this mentality as playing the man, not the ball. Another version of this is, if you can't attack the data, attack the messenger. There is, of course, a difference here between attacking people and asking questions of them, as I tend to do. Asking people questions is different than making rude or inflammatory remarks. Describing them or their evidence, analysis, or conclusions as ridiculous or unbelievable. Perhaps it would be better if more people spent time analyzing the evidence for themselves, and if they can't agree with the experts' conclusions, perhaps they can simply say, "I disagree," rather than being rude and disparaging or claim to have debunked a reasoned analysis, as if it is something to be proud of. If there is honest criticism of the evidence, where it is felt that it is not strong enough, or it is felt that clearer or more powerful evidence has been found, then the sensible thing would surely be to offer to contribute it to the studies which have been posted, collectively, making the case stronger and more overwhelming. Instead of this, we have seen a pattern of 1. Promoting studies which don't explain all the evidence, 2. Ridiculing studies which explain the most evidence, 3. Ignoring, censoring, or soft censoring a discussion of evidence when those having the power of censorship, but a weak or non-existent science or analytical background, become uncomfortable with this discussion. 4. Classifying a group of people who choose to discuss certain evidence or conclusions as either being emotionally unstable or completely nuts. And 5. Ignoring important court cases that focus on a range of evidence analyzed by well-qualified people. For myself, I now feel I have to strongly consider that the actions which have woven this pattern of evidence denial and ridicule are not purely ego-driven or a simple result of people being reluctant to change their minds. I'm coming to the view that there is an active underlying system which is manipulating people into the behavior that has been observed and documented here, which is very much another can of worms to open. So, what is the goal here? Recently, when I was trying to discuss the evidence that some type of technology related to the Hutchison effect was used to destroy the WTC, I was asked, "What is your goal with this?" This, of course, is a very good question, which can also be asked of those promoting the thermite explanations and those who continue to follow the pattern of making disparaging remarks. My goal is to help pave the way for the black technologies that have been used to hold the rest of the world hostage for perhaps 60 years or so to be revealed. An additional goal is that those who are in control of these technologies could be identified and questioned as to what their goal is. An additional goal is that those who are in control of these technologies can be identified and questioned as to what their goal is. My wish is that these revelations will transform our world into one that has more equity, liberty, and peace. In that regard, attacking and ridiculing serious, reasoned, and detailed analyses has no place, especially when some of the people doing this work have made and continue to make very significant personal sacrifices.